My guest this week is the Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. She is also a professor in the School of Social Work at McGill University. Cindy Blackstock is a member of the Gitxsan First Nation with 25 years of social work experience in child protection and Indigenous children rights. 10 years ago, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations filed a Canadian Human Rights Act complaint charging Canada of discriminating against First Nations children by consistently underfunding child welfare on reserves. On January 26, 2016, the tribunal ruled that Canada indeed discriminates against 163,000 First Nations children on the grounds of race and national and ethnic origin. This court case is the subject of a 2016 documentary by Alanis Bompzuin, We Can't Make the Same Mistake Twice, which I attended at its Toronto premiere. Despite this ruling, the federal government's longstanding underfunding of child and family services on First Nations reserves continues. The government continues to defy the court's decision, and it has defied three compliance orders from the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, the most recent in May of this year. Cindy Blackstock is the author of over 50 publications. She's a widely sought-after public speaker and the recipient of several honors and recognitions, including from the Nobel Women's Initiative, the Aboriginal Achievement Foundation, and Frontline Defenders. Cindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Cindy, I started out here talking about we've got some anniversaries here. 10 years of Jordan's Principle, and that was finally recently. Canada said they're going to comply with that. Tell us a bit about Jordan Anderson and Jordan's Principle.
Sure. Jordan River Anderson is from Norway House Cree Nation, and he was born in 1999 on October 22nd. And he had some complex medical needs, so he had to stay in the hospital for the first 2 years of his life. And his dad went up to Norway House to look after the other kids while mom stayed with him. They were so thrilled when, shortly after Jordan's second birthday, doctors said, you know, Jordan is well enough that he can transition into a family home near the hospital until he further stabilizes and then move back up to Norway House Cree Nation. On this point, there is no disagreement. If Jordan was a non-Indigenous child, he would have gone home after his second birthday. But because he was First Nations, Health Canada, Indian Affairs, and the province of Manitoba argued over who should pay because he was a First Nations child. And they decided that they did not want to set a precedent of paying for these services, so they left him in the hospital while they argued over who should pay. And that poor little boy spent over 2.5 years unnecessarily in that hospital while these officials argued. And as his older sister, Jermaine Sullivan, said, you know, in the end, he died of a broken heart. Shortly before his fifth birthday, he slipped into a coma and he passed away at the age of 5, never having spent a day outside of that hospital because he was a First Nations child. His father, Ernest Anderson, and his sisters and extended family said, this cannot happen to another child. And the family was particularly in grief because only 6 months after Jordan passed away, his beloved mother passed away as well. And so Jordan's principle is very simple. It says no child should have to wait for public services that they need because they're First Nations. It applies to all public services. Sometimes you'll hear people say it's health or special needs kids, but it's actually all children and all public services. Education, for example, early childhood programs, health, child welfare, all the rest of it. Now, it passed unanimously in the House of Commons in 2007, and Ernest Anderson and Jerlene were here. And I still remember that night, Wayne. You know, Parliament, all the members of Parliament, they stood, but they remained standing that night. And they gave the family a standing ovation. Ernest Anderson was in the gallery of the House of Commons, and he leaned over the bar and he said, do not let the good being done in my son's name today just be a moral victory. And 10 years later, and 4 court orders later, we're still looking to Canada to fully comply with it.
Okay, so this week, Jane Philpott, the Minister of Indigenous Services, gives a statement on the 10th anniversary of Jordan's principle. I'm sure you've seen this.
Yeah.
I'm going to read it. I'm going to ask you to comment on it.
Okay.
Because the words sound good. They always do. But you tell me how true this rings or how this aligns or doesn't with reality. So it says, we are working with First Nations partners and communities as well as provinces and territories to build a better healthcare structure and funding model for First Nations children over the long term. To help with services needed right away, a fund of $382.5 million has been set up under the Jordan's Principle, a Child First Initiative, to cover health, social, and education services from 2016 to 2019. Since 2016, more than 99% of the requests received under Jordan's Principle have been approved, totaling over 29,000 requests for services and supports. This includes mental health supports, medical equipment, speech therapy, educational supports, and more. We have made significant progress to helping First Nations children access the services they need, but much more work still needs to be done. We will not rest until every First Nations child in Canada can access the services they need without delays and has true equality with all other Canadian children. There is no simple solution. We must continue to collaborate with our partners and remain focused on keeping the best interests of First Nations children as our top priority.
Well, I'd like to say first that any credit for the services does not go to the Government of Canada, in my view. It goes to Jordan River Anderson, his family, and the many families who have sacrificed, and also to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal's ruling. When Canada says it has approved 99% of the services, the piece it's leaving out is that until May of 2017, it was using a definition that was racially discriminatory, according to the tribunal. It was using a very narrow definition that children had to have critical short-term illnesses and a disability. It's only been since then that they have applied it to all public services. And even there, we have significant concerns about INAC, so about its application in education, early childhood, and child welfare. We have seen some progress, some important progress, at Health Canada in its application to health services. But this is all due to the efforts of the Anderson family and to the tribunal's legal orders that they comply with this. On the child and family services piece, they are out of compliance. I have been very clear about that. The tribunal has been very clear about that. There's no order that Canada is in compliance. And the tribunal ordered Canada to equitably fund First Nations children in child welfare on the basis of need. It didn't order Canada to have discussions or sign MOUs. So I have always measured Canada's compliance at the level of children. And when you do that, there is not only more work to be done, there is more compliance with the law that is required by the Government of Canada to end this racial discrimination. And I think that's an important distinction, because when we talk about more work to be done, it sounds like it's elective. In this case, it is not elective. It is a matter of legal orders that Canada has to comply with.
And it says here, this is a phrase that jumps out at me, there is no simple solution. It seems to me you've worked very diligently to say this is what needs to be done, and you're not the only person to provide a pathway forward. Many others have done the same. I mean, it's not like they need to sit down and figure, oh gosh, what do we do?
No, that's exactly right. I think that's a very important point, is that there are solutions on the table. Canada has, up until now, often rejected those solutions, but not provided another solution that would meet the requirements of the order. So there are many good solutions, including in the tribunal's well-thought-out order, that Canada has before it. It doesn't need to think about it or consult about it. It just needs to do it. And I have also seen some great community-level proposals go forward to Canada, and yet they're not being acted on. So that's an important piece that we need to look at, is when Canada knows better, does it do better for First Nations children? And in my view, there hasn't been a lot of evidence of that. And that's why I've been calling for an independent 360-degree evaluation of INAC, so that it can learn from its past conduct in residential schools in the 60s group and in its ongoing racial discrimination against First Nations kids, in ways that prepare it to fully comply with the law on human rights orders and also with UNDRIP and with the TRC's calls to action. Without that internal reform, if Canada continues to take itself off the table when it talks about these things, then I fear that we're going to see a replication of Canada's wayward and destructive conduct towards another generation of First Nations kids.
And that call for review that I saw December 13th, Mark Blackburn, APTN News, advocate calls for full review of Indigenous Affairs departments and bureaucrats that run them. That was the same day that Jane Philpott released her statement on Jordan's principle. So I definitely support that call for some investigation here. I think that's really important.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the minister has made some sincere statements about wanting to create this new Indigenous Services Department that does comply with UNDRIP and these TRC's calls to action. But you can't just import the old colonial structures and ways of thinking and acting at INAC. And when a new political party comes in, expect it to act differently. That is proven to be a false assumption over time. So I would hope that they would welcome that and that they would move quickly to do it. And that evaluation should be public, of course. Something that all Canadians should be able to see and all First Nations should be able to see.
I think people would welcome that, actually.
I think so, too. And, you know, I'd like to see things like when I talk about 360, I mean people at the community level who are being affected by these programs, First Nations leadership, as well as employees within the department, because I have been blessed to work with some really good employees at INAC. But they seem to be successful despite the system, not because of the system. And too often these progressive relationships are person-defendant, and the overall culture of the place has still got very deep colonial bones.
For sure. So just a little bit, this has all been in the past few days. Charlie Angus put in a request. He wanted to know how much the government is paying on legal fees. And it's important to know this is since January 25th, 2016. This is after the tribunal had ruled, after the appeals, so money spent on lawyers, after the case was over and Canada had lost. And that was that. The appeals were done. The amount, according to a document sent by the Justice Minister, Jody Wilson-Raybould, is $807,000. I'm looking at a scan of it right here. Over $800,000 they've spent since the tribunal ruled on legal costs, on lawyers, to fight this.
Yeah, that's astounding to me, you know? And I think it represents that when you're not complying with the law, it's going to cost you a lot of money for your legal counsel, right, to try and defend that position. That $807,000, for example, is way more than the Caring Society operates on a given year. We have a budget of about $400,000 to $500,000 a year. So that would pretty much carry us over two fiscal years. And my legal fees for that same period of time, and keep in mind, we're a party to this case, so you would expect if Canada's paying $807,000 that our fees would be in that same ballpark. And what my fees have been is brownies and cookies that I bake for the lawyers just to say thank you. They are acting pro bono on behalf of all the First Nations children and their families. And I'd like to just personally name them if I could, Wayne, because I think they deserve our collective gratitude. Until recently, it was Sebastian Grimond, who has now become a federal court judge. And continuing on our team is Sarah Clark from Clark Child and Family Law, Anne Levesque from University of Ottawa, and David Taylor from Conway Litigation here in Ottawa. So those guys have worked for free while Canada spent $807,000, which in my view should have been given to children, young people, and their families in the form of different types of family reunification services, family supports, addictions treatment, and that kind of thing.
Well, I like shout-outs. You know, there are a lot of people that have been working on this It's been so long now.
It has been. Even my teddy bear, Spirit Bear, has got an honorary barrister certificate because of his long and detailed service attending all the hearings.
And we're going to definitely talk about that because there's some, it's not all bad. There's some good news there too.
There is.
But I mean, I have to ask, Cindy, because I've got you here, and this is the kind of thing that rattles around in my brain. I mean, you talk to these people, right? You sit down with Bennett and the Philpotts and you may know Jody Wilson-Raybould. I mean, I sort of know her. I remember seeing her around, you know, back when she was one of us.
Yeah.
I mean, what do they say to you? Do you sit in a room with them, you know, close enough to reach out and strangle them maybe? But what is that like?
Well, you know what? I have seen so many prime ministers over the long history of this inequality, and I've seen so many ministers of Indian affairs come and go. I have been pleased with the type of conversation I can have with Minister Philpott recently with that change. I think that was a positive change. She's less likely, I think, to defend the government when they're doing things that are indefensible and more likely to get down to work to try and solve the problems. And I appreciate that. But at the end of the day, what I'm looking for is results at the level of children and families, right? I judge my own work by that. I don't think that, you know, I've been completely successful in that regard. There's a lot more work to be done so that families have a fair go. And I've just realized that the best I can do is try to maintain my integrity and the clarity of focus, which is to make sure these kids get the help they need. And if government wants to be a partner in that, great. And if they don't, then there are other mechanisms to get them to comply, including, you know, public pressure as well as litigation. And we'll do whatever is required, whatever is within our power that's peaceful and respectful to ensure that this generation of First Nations kids get a healthy childhood.
Wow, you're just such a better person than I am. I don't honest to God, I don't think I could deal with these people. I mean, you have to be diplomatic, I don't, but I just think the case against Canada is it's just so easy in a way. I mean, they're clearly this is just a government that's operating on racist, discriminatory principles. That's just the way it is. And you're right. Yeah, you have to judge this stuff by the lives of children. Are they getting better or not? And I just don't see any of these expensive bureaucrats and politicians really doing very much when they could. They easily could. They're not. Don't seem to be doing very much to make that difference, even though there's a plan there, even though all the court cases have come out. I just think, oh, God, you know, they're failing. They're failing.
Yeah. They are, and it's important to, I actually don't even think it's failure anymore. When I look at Canada's history and its relationship with First Nations children, what I see is a repeated pattern of where they knew better and chose not to do better.
Yeah.
It's a conscious choice when you're faced with four legal orders telling you that you're racially discriminating against kids and you choose not to implement the available solutions to stop that. And so I think that we need to stop using the word failure and start using the word conscious choice, because I think it's a proper descriptor. And I think that, you know, generations from now, I want people to look back at this era and know that Canada knew better. And so did the Canadian public.
What do you tell people then? I mean, we're going to talk about the new book, The Spirit Bear Plan, and the book. And I'd like to kind of end with that, because I think it's forward looking. What we're doing is backward looking. I mean, Cindy, part of me was tempted to just do this show and rant about how awful the bureaucrats and the politicians are. I thought that would feel really good. And it's true. And then we could just talk about, you know, some movies we've seen lately or our favorite, our favorite Montreal restaurants.
But you know, one of the problems with government, and this is part of the colonial pattern, is they always want to look forward, right? They'll say, oh, we're sorry about the past, but we're looking forward now. So we don't want to talk about the past. And what that is code for is we don't want to be accountable for our conduct. We don't want to have to look in the mirror and reform ourselves as a government. And to me, that is one of the fundamental flaws in the way that repeated governments of different political parties have managed this whole situation. I say, no, you don't get to look forward until you look at yourself and reform your own conduct. I think it's absolutely essential that they do that. And I think they need some independent help, and there probably are going to have to be some personnel changes, because there will be people who are willing to learn and willing to reform themselves, and I've seen that over time. And there's also people who are just firmly entrenched in that colonial thinking. And often they are at the top of the organization, at the ADM and the DM level.
What do you do when you're not fighting racist governments? You got any hobbies or anything?
I like I do like home little repairs. I like doing traveling. I like just baking and, you know, doing stuff like that. I just like a normal everyday person, like just doing those basic things to me really are a huge kind of blessing in my life. Hanging out, going out for coffee with friends, doing stuff like that. And of course, you know, surrounding myself with a gazillion teddy bears, which I have in my office here.
Really?
Yeah, I think I've got my latest census, I think I'm over 30 teddy bears now.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're
more recently writing children's books, right?
So yeah. You're leading me here. You're segueing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do it then. Let's talk about the Spirit Bearer and Children Make History book and the plan.
Yeah. You know what? When I look back at this whole case, there are so many different elements we could talk about. We could talk about the legal wrangling, how Canada tried repeatedly to hold itself unaccountable under its own laws, the retaliation, the breaking of its own laws in terms of withholding documents, all that nonsense. But to me, the most important story of the case is how children, First Nations children and other children, came together to stand up for justice in that courtroom. You know, when we filed it, even amongst the First Nations community, there was some support, but there wasn't a lot of people showing up for the hearings. The first groups to show up to the hearings were children and teenagers. They're the ones that started to fill up the seats in the courtroom. And this was at a time when Canada was trying all the procedural stuff, so it wasn't the most exciting testimony to listen to. But the children could see through all of that and realize that this is just wrong, right? There's no excuse for this. Why would some kids get treated with less services than other kids because of their race? It's just wrong. There's no excuse for it. There's no need to consult about it. This is just wrong, and someone needs to stand up for it. And so the children did, and not only did they come once, but many of these children have grown up with this case, and they continue to write letters to the government. They continue to speak to their friends and families, and this has really become a huge movement among children. The tribunal and Shannon Kustachin and her inspiration of Shannon's Dream and the TRC, all of that came together to inspire a new generation of kids to say, this is nonsense. And I think that's going to create the most sustainable change in Canada, because I don't think the federal government has fully appreciated that there is a generation of Canadians coming up who are not going to tolerate this one bit. And it's not going to look back favorably on governments who persisted with this behavior when they could have done better. So that's what I wanted to write the story about, is how children can see this injustice and how First Nations kids didn't normalize it like people of my generation did. I think we were so used to getting less that we never really kind of woke up to the injustice of it. But this generation of First Nations kids knows they're being treated unjustly, and they're not prepared to just sit down and take it. And then the non-Indigenous kids, when they hear about it, are prepared to stand up and write and go to Parliament and talk to their parents, but do something. Caring isn't enough. They know that. They want to change things for kids, and they're doing it. And so that's what Spirit Bear's book is about. And Spirit Bear is a teddy bear gifted to me by Carrier Second E Family Services back in 2007. And I just fell in love with this teddy bear right away. And I just thought, well, I got to put him to work if I'm going to keep him instead of giving him to kids. So he went to all the hearings and he saw all the hearings, and the children would often come and take him and go tell them him stories about what they had learned. And he became a real ambassador for reconciliation, so much so that he's been dressed by community members. He doesn't wear anything but haute couture that the community members have made for him. He even has an original string of Hudson Bay trading beads. And then this year, he's taken over one of the shelves in my office. I've had to move out all my stuff for all of his awards. So he got a certificate from Osgoode Law School for being a barrister.
Of course.
It says, for courageous support and bearing witness, i.e. B-E-A-R, yeah. Right? Witness, throughout a long and difficult process of truth-telling and healing. So he's a barrister, and he's also been recognized by the Indigenous Bar Association. He's been admitted to the bear, so he's official. And, you know, he's like a superstar, this bear. So he's the one that tells the story about these kids coming together. And we wanted to create this children's book to honor the children who did this, but also to inspire other children to realize that their voices have power and what they say and do counts and can change society for the better.
So this is a book you can pick up at, online or at your local bookstore?
No, unfortunately, it's just available via the Caring Society. So you can send us a note at info@fncaringsociety.com. That's info@fncaringsociety.com. And we're selling them for $15, and all the proceeds go to children's reconciliation projects.
And so this is a book for children, so age group, kind of like, is there a range there?
Well, it's beautifully illustrated by Amanda Strong, and Eddie Robinson also assisted me with the writing of it. So it's really good. It's good for kids about 5 to about 10, but really for any age.
For anybody.
For anybody. You know, you can show it. We've had people buy it for toddlers because they can just read it along with their parents, and both of them can learn as they tell this great story. And the wonderful thing is that Spirit Bear also has a calendar that guides children through a whole year of reconciliation, things they can do as children or with their families or people can do in their workplaces that are free of charge that promote the TRC's calls to action.
And, of course, people can go to your website and support the First Nation Caring Society as well. Yep.
And get the calendar, yeah.
Get the calendar. Christmas season is coming, so you could even make a donation in someone's name, couldn't you? That sort
you
of thing.
You could do that. Absolutely. And as I say, I think we're still, I mean, you would know better than I am, Wayne, because you do the rounds with the Indigenous organizations. But I think we're the only Indigenous national organization that doesn't take the government money.
Yeah, gosh, there aren't many. And that's really important because money comes with strings.
Yeah, it does. And you know what? We may not have a lot of it, but we're so blessed to have so much community support, and that has made all the difference.
You're punching above your weight there, Cindy. You guys have just been doing so much. I love the campaigns that you come up with and the way that you do advocacy. And I mean, I don't know who comes up with all your ideas, but they're just really great ideas. Got a good team. How big is your team there?
Well, a lot of people think we have a big team, but we actually only have one full-time employee and 4 part-time employees. That's how big the Caring Society is. But I don't ever want to see it get huge. I just really want to see it. I think that we do better when we're small and humble. We have a lot of used furniture in our office. You know, it's as somebody called it, a part First Nations art gallery because of the stuff First Nations have given us, and part kitchen fridge with all the teddy bears and everything else that kids have given us. And that's the way I always want it to be. I don't think you have to have a massive organization when you believe that the solutions are in the communities. Our job is simply to create the resources and the flexibility for communities to implement their own best solutions and to do our part to empower a generation of First Nations and non-Indigenous kids to be a part of this whole process.
One last thing I need to talk to you about, Cindy, because I've been thinking about it a lot, and I have a feeling, you can tell me, but I have a feeling you have some thoughts about this, and you're somebody I look to with expertise and experience. So the 60s scoop, there's now been a class action suit, the Marcia Martel Brown suit, Brown versus Ontario. I met Marcia in Vancouver not too long ago. We spent a couple days together. I've been thinking a lot about this, and there's going to be money for a foundation. There's maybe an agreement that covers all of Canada, all of the native kids who were adopted into white families. What are your thoughts about maybe some, what we might hope to see coming out of this, specifically around, you know, things like healing and addressing this legacy, because it touches upon child and family welfare and the child family welfare system and all of that stuff. So do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Marcia and the other 60 Scoop survivors for pressing for this justice. I think it's really important that we recognize and hold up people like her. When I heard about the $50 million, that's not a lot of money for what needs to be done. And a couple of the things that came to my mind are, one of the things that we really needed across the country is reunification help for 60 Scoop survivors. And that has to take many forms because people are at different stages. For some, it's a kind of a grieving process, sometimes of the reality of what you lost, but equally important, the dream that you lost, the perception of what you lost. And sometimes those are different things, right? When you've grown up without connection to your family, you often imagine or you dream what that might have looked like. And that process needs to be supported. People need to have an opportunity to work that through. And for some people, that'll be on an individual level. For some people, that may be on a group level. And for others, it will be actually being wanting to, at some point, reunify with their communities. And there needs to be supports at both sides of that when that happens, not just for the initial event, but over the longer term. So I'm hoping there's some thinking around how to support people with that. And it's not just the individual 60 Scoop survivor. It's important to realize that these 60 Scoop survivors have children, right? And partners, that there are going to be a part of this. So we need to support the whole family. The other thing, though, I think, and this is what I've been hammering on for most of my life, is that we got to stop this, right? The 60 Scoop, in many ways, is just a warm-up to what we're at today. And, you know, at some point, I wanted to see you stop seeing these apologies. So I would love to see the 60 Scoop pieces, some of that money going to say, okay, so why didn't governments do better after residential school? Right? They're like, why did they replicate in many ways the same bad conduct? And what could be done to make sure that this doesn't happen again? It kind of circles back to that argument about the 360 evaluation as part of the Spirit Bear plan, right? The need for that. Those are kinds of the things I'd like to see. And I think the Spirit Bear plan is absolutely essential to doing that. So not only the 360 evaluation and Spirit Bear plan, but one of the most important components of it is asking the parliamentary budget officer to cost out all of the inequalities First Nations kids experience in education, child and maternal health, mental health, the whole works. Because what has happened over the last 150 years, Wayne, is they've costed them out one program at a time and they've dealt with them one teaspoon at a time. Right. But never enough to fully eradicate the inequality. I want to know what that big number looks like. How much is government saving by racially discriminating against kids? And then let's work together to develop a Marshall Plan. Remember after the Second World War, they developed the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe in 10 years? And they did it. So why on earth can't we do the same thing to end racial discrimination against little kids? But not take 10 years, because that's a whole generation, but to do it a lot quicker than that. I think Canadians are ready for it. I really do. I think the Canadian public's ready for it. I think the government just underestimates the readiness of the Canadian public. I think the Canadian public's had enough of this. They want to see this generation of kids being treated fairly.
Well, if they are interested in supporting, there's ways they can do that. They can support your organization. They can support the cause. I can get behind these calls. There's plans. There are numbers here. I mean, there's really just political and public will. If we all get behind this and push, I think we can make that difference. That seems like a good plan to me.
Me too. And you know what? I think the very best Christmas presents cost nothing. Right? And this is something every person can do, is they can go onto our website at fncaringsociety.com and find 7 free ways to make a difference. And they could also find the Spirit Bear plan there and send that to your member of parliament. It doesn't cost you anything. And you know what? That small action is a huge gift to over 165,000 kids and to the country too. I've always said ending this racial discrimination is not just good for First Nations kids, it's good for Canada. You know, the U.S. was a better country after the Civil Rights Movement, and South Africa was a better country after ending apartheid. And Canada will be a better country when it stops racially discriminating against little First Nations kids, Métis kids, and Inuit kids.
Well, it just makes sense to invest in children because they're going to grow up and you're either going to get it right or you're not, you know?
That's right. And the Chief Justice in her interview with Michael Enright was pointing that out, right? She sees the overrepresentation in the justice system over her 28 years in the Supreme Court of Canada and says the answer to that, one of the major answers, is treating these kids properly when they're young.
There you go. It seems like a no-brainer to me.
Somehow. Me too, but, Wayne.
Yeah. Well, Cindy, I really thank you for giving me your time today.
Hey, thank you.
I hope you have a great Christmas there, a Merry Christmas and a Happy Holiday, and you get a little break, and you come out fighting in 2018.
I will be, and Spirit Bear will be there too.
Yeah, let's make this the year.
I would like that. I think that would be a great gift, you know, starting the 151st year of this country free of racial discrimination against little kids. That would be a great year.
Thank you so much for what you do, Cindy.
Hey, you too, Wayne. All the best to you.